Give thanks to the Lord, for He is good. His love endures forever. Welcome to the weekly sermon podcast of the Cape Elizabeth Church of the Nazarene in Cape Elizabeth, Maine. Download more sermons or learn about the Cape Elizabeth Church of the Nazarene at our website, capenazarene.org. Here's Pastor John Twitchell as he delivers this week's message.
While he may have been a short man, he was still very much a grown man. That sentence is important to everything else I'm going to say this morning, so let me just say it one more time. While he may have been a short man, he was still very much a grown man. And there are certain things grown men do not do, right? Grown men, for instance, grown men don't hike up their skirts and go running through the town. Grown men don't climb trees. And grown men don't play hide and seek. At least not in that culture. Those are undignified things for any grown man to do, particularly in that culture, particularly in that time, and especially for a grown man with position, influence, and authority and wealth like Zacchaeus had. I know, the story of Zacchaeus is familiar to us. It's a story we learned young. We sang the little song about him when we were a kid. We know he was short and he couldn't see over the crowd, so he climbed up in a tree so he could see Jesus. And if that's all we know about Zacchaeus, we know something good and important about Zacchaeus, but I suspect there's much more for us to understand about Zacchaeus as we look at his story. Now, there are good reasons we teach this story to children, right? This is an easy story to teach to children. They get this story, right? Children intuitively understand what it's like to be a short person trying to see what's going on. Children know what it's like to see a face full of knees and legs and backsides when there's other stuff they'd really rather be looking at. Children know what it's like to be hoisted up onto dad's shoulder so they can see the parade going by. More than anything else, children know what it's like to be on the outside looking in. So there's a reason this is an attractive story to tell to children. And if nothing else, children know what it's like to try to climb a tree. But if that's all we know about Zacchaeus, we may have missed some of the things we ought to learn about Zacchaeus' story, because Zacchaeus is not only a story about a short man. It's not just a fun story about this funny little man who climbed up in a tree so he could see Jesus. This is a story that cuts to the heart of what it means to be the people of God, that cuts to the heart of what it means to relate to the outsider, the outcast, the sinner. This is a story about an outsider, and it's a story about how religious insiders tend to treat people who aren't like us. This is a story, believe it or not, this is a story about someone who may have been running because they were afraid for their life. A grown man who was willing to be undignified, willing to go out on a limb, if you will, in order to catch just a glimpse of the divine. We'll unpack all of that this morning, but in case you missed it, let me point this out one more time. Zacchaeus may have been a short man, but he was still a grown man. And grown men don't run, grown men don't climb trees, and grown men don't play hide and seek, at least not in that culture. But Zacchaeus did. See, we tend to forget Zacchaeus would have been wearing some long flowing robe of some kind, and to read that he ran ahead of the crowd means that he would have had to pick up those skirts and run in a rather undignified manner to get to where he was going. Grown men didn't do that. And Luke is careful to point out that this is a sycamore tree that he is climbing, and that doesn't mean much to us because we don't have sycamore trees and we don't have all of the cultures and customs that were associated with sycamore trees. You can see that that's a pretty massive tree. You may not be able to tell, but those are people in the foreground underneath that sycamore tree. And so Luke's readers would have immediately got something that we don't get when they read that Zacchaeus went and climbed in a sycamore fig tree. They have broad leaves, they have dense foliage, they're huge and overspreading, ideal for hiding. The other thing that isn't obvious to us is because of the nature of the sycamore tree, because of some of the ceremonial and religious implications of cleanliness, and because of the way that that tree just overspread itself, sycamore trees were not allowed in town. You couldn't plant a sycamore tree in your front yard in Jericho, because it would overspread into all of your neighbors' yards as well. It wasn't allowed. In fact, the Mishnah says that you couldn't plant a sycamore tree, you couldn't grow a sycamore tree any closer than 75 feet away from the gates of the city. So suddenly our picture of Zacchaeus changes. He's not just, you know, trotting a half a block away and climbing up the first available tree so he can see. Zacchaeus is hiking up his skirts. He's running not only to the edge of town, but he's running outside town, 75 feet beyond, at least 75 feet beyond the outside of the town gate, to climb up in a tree in which he could hide. Powerful, rich men in the Middle East, do not risk shame by doing the things that Zacchaeus is publicly doing that day. Why is Zacchaeus doing this, you might ask? Why doesn't Zacchaeus just climb up on a rooftop or stand in a balcony? Whoa. Goodness, he's an important person. Why doesn't Zacchaeus just cry out, "Make way!" and expect the crowd to part so he can walk through and he can see Jesus? Well, I'm glad you asked those questions today. We want to try to unpack the story of Zacchaeus a little bit, and in order to do that, we really have to understand his position within the community. Now, you already know that he was a tax collector. You read that part. None of us like the tax man, right? With apologies to any tax men who are watching this morning. I don't think there are any in the room, but just in case you're watching, with apologies, none of us really like the tax man. But you understand that for Zacchaeus, it was more than just they didn't like the tax man, right? Zacchaeus wasn't collecting the temple tax. Zacchaeus wasn't collecting the local city of Jericho tax to help run the city of Jericho. Zacchaeus was a collaborator. Zacchaeus was a collaborator with the Roman government, collecting the Roman tax and allowed to keep a portion of that for himself. The more he collected, the more he got to keep. See, it wasn't just that these people didn't like the tax man. Zacchaeus was universally despised because of who he was and what he did. I mean, if he had been a respected individual within the city of Jericho, clearly this crowd would have just parted and let him see Jesus. They would have made way for him. They would have been used to doing that. No, Zacchaeus was, if I could use the words, Zacchaeus was despised and rejected. I want to go a step further and suggest that Zacchaeus may have actually even been afraid for his life in terms of this crowd, this mob of people. I don't know this for sure, but a couple scholars suggested it, and I think there's a good point. This crowd considered him not only an outsider, but a collaborator, a consorter with the enemy. If they had had a chance, they might have set up a trial, tried him and convicted him of fraternization. But with a crowd this size, they didn't even need to do that. Even today in the Middle East, those who collaborate with the occupying government are always afraid for their life, always watching their back. For a collaborator to mix in with a crowd is a deadly thing to do, because all it takes is one person, one knife, and nobody knows the collaborator is dead until the crowd has moved on and he's left lying in the middle of the street. For a collaborator who's also a short person, it would have been easy to knock Zacchaeus out, and nobody would have known who did it. No, I think Zacchaeus probably avoided crowds for that very reason, and I think he wasn't just running on ahead so he could see. I think he was running on ahead because he was afraid for his life. He picks up his skirts, he runs on ahead at least 75 feet, but probably more than that because he has to get out of the city first, and then he climbs a tree. He hides himself in the dense foliage, and he hopes. He hopes the crowd has dispersed by the time they get to his lookout space. He hopes that maybe as Jesus is going from Jericho to Jerusalem, that the crowd kind of starts to fade away, and maybe it's just Jesus going by, maybe Jesus and his closest followers, and he gets to catch a glimpse. After all, if he were discovered, if this crowd saw him, Zacchaeus is now in an extremely vulnerable position, isn't he? Like a wild animal treed by a pack of dogs. Zacchaeus is at the mercy of the angry mob. So Zacchaeus finds his hiding place. He He waits. He listens. The crowd begins to approach. He watches. He waits. He listens. He hopes. He hopes that they'll pass by. He'll be able to see and hear, but that he will remain unseen and unnoticed. But then the unthinkable happens. Jesus calls out to him by name. How? How did Jesus see him in this hiding place? How did Jesus know he was there? How did Jesus know his name? And Luke doesn't give us more than just a couple of hints about the reaction of the crowd. But we have to imagine just a little bit, and I think we can imagine the reaction of the crowd as Jesus calls out his name, a name well known to the residents of Jericho. And as they watch Zacchaeus begin to climb down out of the tree, I can imagine, at least empowered by anonymity, empowered by numbers, perhaps they began to hurl their insults to call Zacchaeus all the names they had ever wanted to call him but never quite dared to do so, because now they can hide in the crowd and do it. Outnumbered and outflanked, there's nothing for Zacchaeus to do to fight back or to shield himself from their taunts and their jeers. And in my imagination, at least, and I know I'm departing from Luke quite a bit at this point, but let me imagine for you just for a moment. In my imagination, the crowd is throwing their taunts and their jeers at Zacchaeus, and then they kind of recognize that Jesus wants to say something, so they quiet up for a minute. Shh, the rabbi's going to speak. And I think the crowd is hoping Jesus is going to chime in. That Jesus is going to have a speech of condemnation, a sermon of hellfire and brimstone for this collaborator of Rome who's oppressing the very people of God, who is enriching themselves at their economic lifeblood. I think they wanted Jesus to justify their hatred of this funny little man up in the tree. If that's what they wanted, then surely they were disappointed, because that's not at all what Jesus did. Instead, Jesus calls to him by name, tells him to come down out of the tree, and Jesus invites himself over to Zacchaeus' house to share a meal and to spend the night. And the crowd goes wild. Previously was turned in upset toward Zacchaeus, now their taunts and their jeers and their anger and their mumblings and their complainings begin to be turned against Jesus. Think about it for just a minute. We're in a Middle Eastern city. We're known for hospitality. The great teachers come through our city. He spent time in Jerusalem. How many invitations do you think Jesus got that day? How many people do you suppose were angling for a chance to say, "Hey, Jesus, you got dinner plans tonight?" I mean, the general superintendent was here just a week ago, and I know of at least a couple people who tried to see if the general superintendent already had dinner plans lined up. Imagine Jesus coming through your city. How many people are going to say, "Who's he going to eat supper with? Who's he going to spend the night with?" I imagine Jesus got dozens of invitations that day, people angling to see who was worthy to have the rabbi stay under their house and in their guest room and eat at their table. Jesus turned them all down. He's on his way out of Jericho to the next place he's going. And instead, he goes ahead and makes his very own invitation, and he invites himself over to the chiefest of sinners, to the chief collaborator with the Roman governor. He's going to eat with an unclean man at an unclean table and spend the night in an unclean bed in an unclean guest room. And the crowd goes wild, and their taunts and jeers previously directed at Zacchaeus now are turned at the rabbi, turned at Jesus. And in a demonstration of the cruciform life, Jesus accepts the taunts and jeers that were rightly directed at another. Jesus absorbs the hatred of Zacchaeus upon himself, providing a foretaste of what would happen at the cross. Well, so here's the story. Zacchaeus, of course, comes down from the tree. He welcomes Jesus. He immediately repents. He offers not only to give half of his wealth to the poor, but to pay back anyone he has cheated, not only plus interest, but four times the amount that he's cheated them. And Jesus tells the crowd, he says, "Look, today, salvation has come to this house. And even collaborators with the empire can be welcomed as children of Abraham and children of God." That's the story of Zacchaeus, as I sort of, in my prayerful imagination of the story and my understanding of the culture. It begins to take root in my own life and how I see this story having played out. And I don't normally do three-point sermons. In fact, I was exhorted just a week ago not to do three-point sermons, but today I'm going to break that rule. And there are three lessons I kind of picked up from the story I want to share today. And the first two are really quick. The third one's going to take a little more explanation. But the first one is this, and it's a challenge to us, isn't it? It's a challenge to the church because we're the crowd. I mean, we're the crowd around Jesus. We're the ones who would push the outsider away, maybe even with some names or some labels. And this is a lesson to us not to do that, to consider more constructive and Jesus-like ways to engage the outsider, the people who aren't like us, the flagrant sinner, even those who would seem to be collaborators with the evil empire. It's not our job, church, to hurl insults. It's not our job to keep the sinner at arm's length. I'd even dare say it's not our job to convince them of their sin. It's not our job to label or define. It is instead our job to image and reflect Jesus. And Jesus knows them by name, calls them down out of their hiding place and says, "Why don't you exchange that hiding place and I'll come to your house today?" To enter into relationship with them, even if it's a great risk to our own holiness reputation. And so that's the first call I hear is for us as a church to consider how we engage the outsider and the sinner and the collaborator. But the second thought I have, I told you these were going to be short. The second thought I had is kind of more the traditional message of Zacchaeus, right? It's the title of today's sermon, Out on a Limb. And I hear this as a call for us to be willing to be undignified in this pursuit of Jesus, to pick up our skirts and to run and go out on a limb in order to see Jesus at the risk of our own reputation, at the risk of our own dignity, to leave everything else behind in this passionate pursuit of the divine, to be willing to do something crazy or risky, even unsafe, in order to know Jesus and to know him more. This is a call to abandon our own patterns, our routines, our comfort zones, to take a risk and pursue the voice of God that we hear in the middle of the night. It may not make sense. It might disappoint others. It might even put us on the outside looking in. But the story of Zacchaeus is a call for us to be undignified, to risk shame, and to abandon whatever needs to be abandoned in order to catch a glimpse of the divine and pursue God's call in our life. Those are the first two lessons that come to mind. The third one will take just a little more explanation. I told you I was going to go back to Psalm 32 this morning, and I don't have all sorts of it on the screen, so if you want to open to Psalm 32, you're certainly welcome to. But we heard that beautiful call to worship. And it's a psalm that talks about the interplay between the guilt of our sin and the blessings of forgiveness. In verses 1 and 2 of Psalm 32, they state the condition of one who's been forgiven. They're blessed. Blessed are those who've been forgiven. That when we're forgiven, we can be at peace with God and everything can be right with God. But David, the psalm writer, he starts there, but it becomes quickly evident this is not David's journey. This is not David's story of immediately being blessed, because he then goes back in time and he says, "Let me tell you about a time when I tried to hide from God." And David tells us how he felt weak, wasting away, full of groaning. You've been there, haven't you? You can't sleep. You rehearse the words you're going to use to defend your actions to the person you wronged. Your body begins to show signs of weariness, for the spiritual issue that's been weighing you down affects your body and your heart and your mind and your soul, your whole being. You lay there and you turn over the options in your head of what am I going to do and how am I going to defend myself and what's the next steps. And finally, you come to the realization that David came to, that you can't simply ignore the problem, but the only way out is to simply come clean and to offer confession in hopes of reconciliation. And when you get to verses 4 and 5 of Psalm 32, that's apparently what David's done, that he confesses his sins, he receives forgiveness, and he reminds us the only path out of our guilt is confession. The only way to escape the weight of our sins is to bring them to God so God can lift the weight from us as only he can, and it's only then that we can experience the blessings of Psalm 32:1. That blessed are those who are forgiven. So a quick outline of Psalm 32, we start with blessed is the person who's been forgiven, and then ruined are those who attempt to remain silent, who attempt to hide their sins and keep them to themselves. But here again, what David writes in verse 7. In fact, why don't you read it with me? You are my hiding place. You will protect me from trouble and surround me with songs of deliverance. Hiding. We all know what it is to hide, right? And hide and seek is one of the earliest games we learned to play as children. It doesn't require any special skills or equipment, just a few friends, whatever hiding places that happen to be available in the area we're using. A good hider knows how to find the best hiding places that are close to safety so they can run back when the seeker is out looking somewhere else. You know, those hide and seek skills kind of stick with us. Children, they know how to hide when they're in trouble, right? Do you ever hide in your room hoping dad would forget that you were in trouble until after he'd gone to bed? Or run away to escape a punishment? Or stay home sick from school because you couldn't bear to face whatever was going to happen at school the next day? Maybe you needed an extra day to complete your homework. Kids know how to hide, but guess what, gang? That behavior doesn't stop just because we grow up. We avoid people we've wronged. We hide behind our telephones and computers and escape contact with real people. We've even got house architecture down to a science in this part of the world, right? Our attached two-car garages, which allow us to drive in and close the garage door and have immediate access to our house without encountering our neighbors. We go out on our back deck instead of our front porch. We build trees and hedges around it so we have privacy. Oh, we've become experts at hiding. Me too, by the way. We're good at it. It's interesting. You know sycamore fig, well, at least fig leaves. We don't know if they were sycamore fig leaves, but you know fig leaves come into play very early on in the Bible, don't you? Good old Adam and Eve were pretty good at hiding. Genesis chapter 3, they'd eaten from the forbidden fruit. They hid their nakedness behind fig leaves, and then they tried to hide from God among the trees of the garden. As if they could somehow hide from Almighty God. But we've often all tried to do what Adam and Eve did, to run and hide from our wrongdoings, our problems, our broken relationships, even at times to run and hide from God. It might have been because of sin or a destructive habit or because we knew he was calling us to something specific that maybe we didn't want to do. So there are lots of reasons that we've gotten good at hiding. Are we afraid that God can actually see into the depths of our heart? Might he not like what he finds there? Do we have an acute sense of guilt regarding a specific sin? Or maybe we're afraid of the crowds hiding in a tree. Maybe we're just overwhelmed with life and so we want to retreat into our turtle shell and hide from it all. So where do you go when it's time to hide? Maybe as a child you went in your closet, or maybe a treehouse, or an adult, maybe a particular room in the house that allows you to retreat from everyone else. If we're trying to hide from God, there are other things we might do. We might avoid church or friends from church. We might change our television habits. We might find something else to occupy ourselves to keep us busy. The volume of our televisions and our radios often help us to hide from God. Sometimes we find lots of good things to do. We give our money generously, or we invest ourselves into other activities in hopes it will cover our sins. But here's the thing, and we all know it to be true, right? I can't hide from God. You can't hide from God. We can't cover up our sins. We can't take fig leaves of Adam and Eve and hide ourselves behind our good deeds or our generosity. We can't, like Zacchaeus, just run ahead of the crowd and climb up into a very dense, broad-leafed, foliaged tree and hope that God won't see us. So the question is, where can you run? Where can you hide? And one of my favorite psalms is Psalm 139 that suggests you can't hide anywhere. And even the darkness will be like light when God looks for you. Christian fiction writer Frank Peretti gives sort of a paraphrase of part of Psalm 139 in his 1992 book, Prophet. And I just love the way he writes this. But here's how he puts it. If I flee down this alley, you're there. If I get in my car and get out of town, you'll be right there in the car with me. If I duck into the subway, you'll be right there in the tunnel. I could turn on the television and maybe drown you out, but that won't make you go away. I could buy things to push you from my mind, but you'd still be there when I tired of them. When we surround ourselves with busyness or materialism or noise, we often realize that what we're actually trying to do is to escape into ourselves and escape the presence of God, to hide ourselves in our brokenness. So we might think that hiding is a bad thing. I've made a pretty good case this morning for hiding being a bad thing, haven't I? You know, Psalm 32, though, Psalm 32 invites us to hide. Psalm 32 actually invites us to run and hide, but not to run and hide from God, but to run and hide in God. God doesn't mind if you need to run and hide. God welcomes your desire to hide. In fact, God desires to come and abide with you and in you, not only for you to hide in God, but to God to find his hiding place in you, for Jesus to go over to your house, to eat at my unclean dinner table and spend the night in my unclean guest room. God doesn't mind if we need to run and hide. The question is, which direction are we going to run? Where are we going to find our hiding place? Like Adam and Eve, will we cover ourselves with fig leaves? Like Zacchaeus, will we run and climb a tree hoping to remain unnoticed? And see, this is what I think the main point of the story of Zacchaeus is. It's not so much about Zacchaeus going out on a limb to catch a glimpse of the divine. It's about the divine seeing Zacchaeus in Zacchaeus' hiding place and inviting him to come down because the divine wants to go to his house. The story of Zacchaeus reminds us that God sees us hiding in no matter what it is we're hiding in, wherever we're hiding, God sees us. He calls us by name and he invites himself into our messy lives, into our brokenness. He invites us to stop hiding in the things of this world and to find our hiding place and our deliverance in him. So here's the good news of the gospel today for all of us. Is this, when we feel worthless, we've goofed, we've blown it, we've messed up, we've simply shown our true colors as humans, that is precisely the moment when God is most ready to call us down out of our hiding place and to invite himself into our lives. And instead of running away from God and attempting to hide from him, the call is to run toward him, for he is our hiding place. He alone can rescue us. And like Zacchaeus, when we go out on a limb for Jesus, when we're called out of our hiding place, when we welcome Jesus into our home, we are truly transformed. When we welcome Jesus into our lives and allow him to change us, we will never, never be the same again.
The Lord bless you and keep you. The Lord make his face shine upon you and be gracious to you. The Lord turn his face toward you and give you peace. Amen. Thank you for joining us for this sermon podcast. We hope that the message has inspired you to draw closer to God each day. Pastor John would love to hear from you with any questions or just to let him know where you're listening from. You can send him an email at pastorjohn@capenazarene.org. May God bless you as you serve him today.